Case number 11-3072, United States of America v. Reginald Clark, Appellant. Ms. Ellsworth for the Appellant, Ms. Kelly for the Appellee.
Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court, Jessica Ellsworth, on behalf of Court-Appointed Counsel for Appellant Reginald Clark. The briefs in this case raise a lot of issues, but I'd like to begin with the two sentencing issues. The first of those, and the reason for that is that Mr. Clark, his anticipated release date is in 21 months, and these two sentencing issues collectively added 17 months to the high end of his guideline range. The first of those two issues involves the use of the 2010 guidelines manual to calculate the range. And just before Your Honors took the bench, I was informed by the government that they do not contest that this case should go back for resentencing using the 2002 guidelines manual and the base offense level for the conduct here. So that issue I think we can resolve very quickly. The second sentencing issue is the 3B1.1 enhancement. That is an enhancement that was applied to Mr. Clark for being a leader or organizer of another criminally responsible person. This, too, I think requires resentencing. And the reason for that is very straightforward. This court has said repeatedly that this enhancement requires a finding that the defendant exercised control over another criminally responsible participant. Here, the only other participants who could fall within that standard are the two cousins who had a bank account in Connecticut. And the findings of fact that the district court made, which are reflected in the pre-sentence report, say nothing about any sort of control relationship between Mr. Clark and those two other individuals.
Where does that idea come from, the control?
It comes from a couple places, Judge Randolph. It comes from the application notes to the guidelines manual, which talk about exercising control. And they talk about various factors you can use to see that control is met. Factors including...
Well, the third, I don't have it in front of me. Is that in the, are the advisory notes in an appendix?
I believe they are in an appendix to, I'm not sure to which brief. I can...
To your brief?
I will have to check, Your Honor.
Well, I'll do this from memory. The third note lists a series of factors. There's a distinction in 3B1.1 between being a supervisor and a manager, or a manager, on the one hand, and being an organizer or a leader on the other hand. And in the third advisory note, there are a list of factors, many of which, about whether to provide that enhancement. And many of them don't seem to have anything to do with controlling another person. Am I right about that?
I think to address, there are seven factors.
If you get more money, or if you're the one that dreamed up the scheme, you did this and that and the other thing, it doesn't have anything to do with controlling somebody else.
I think one of the factors explicitly does talk about the degree of control or authority over others.
It's just one of many factors, but...
Correct.
It's not written as if that's a necessary fact.
It is not written as though that's a necessary fact in the list of factors themselves.
Have we ever parsed that language in an opinion?
This court has a number of opinions that talk about control being a prerequisite.
Is that Quigley?
Quigley is one of them, yes. Carter from 2006 is another
one.
Quigley
says all persons receiving an enhancement must exercise some control over others, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So is that where it comes from?
That's one of the places it comes from. Mm-hmm. I think the earliest decision I'm aware of from this court that says that is the 1997 decision, BAPACK, U.S. v. BAPAC, where the court explained that having control over a scheme is not enough, that it is control over a participant that is required for the 3B1.1 enhancement. And that's what the court was referring to again in the Quigley decision you cited, Judge Tatel. And I think one other place that you can find that is in Application Note 2, where Application Note 2 talks about someone who merely exercises management responsibility over the property or assets at issue is not sufficient to qualify for the enhancement. Instead, what we're talking about...
Before you go on, I'm looking at Quigley now. But Quigley is a decision not under 3B1.1C, but under 3B1.1B. And B requires, the person has, as I recall, I don't have it in front of me, but B deals with managers and supervisors. So what Quigley says seems to me to make perfect sense, but that's not a decision under C, which deals with organizers and leaders. You could, I mean, I suppose you could be an organizer of a scheme and then back away and watch it get put into action while somebody else manages it and supervises it, can't you?
I think under this court's precedent, that wouldn't be sufficient. And I think this may be one of the reasons that the precedent the government relies on is largely precedent from outside of the D.C. Circuit. This court has been...
Quigley, like I said, I'm just looking at it now, is we read subsection B to sweep in lower-level managers and supervisors, and A to encompass higher-level managers and supervisors, blah, and so on and so forth. So Quigley doesn't do it. What is the other case you cited?
I think there is a line in Quigley, Your Honor, just to push back on that for 1 second, where the court says all persons receiving the 3B1.1 enhancement without qualifying among the different subsections of the enhancement. All persons receiving
this... Well, that's got to be dicta then, because the subsection C was not involved in the case.
It wasn't, but the goal of this enhancement is to figure out when someone is more culpable than someone else who's involved in the same conspiracy.
If somebody devises the scheme, makes it up, tells people this is the way you can defraud the bank, and then go ahead and do it, aren't they more culpable than the people that get involved in carrying out the scheme the person devises?
I think that's one of the issues this court was addressing in the Carter decision, which is another one that I would point Your Honor to, where the court said that merely being the orchestrator or even the hub of a scheme is not enough. What's key is that there be control over another individual. And one reason for that is there's a separate enhancement here that was applied to Mr. Clark, the abuse of trust enhancement, that we have not challenged on appeal. And that abuse of trust enhancement applies when someone in a position of authority at an employer, for example, the bank in this case, used that position and abused their position of trust. And these two enhancements get at different things. So the facts that you're talking about, Judge Randolph, go more towards, I think, the abuse of trust enhancement, whereas the aggravating role enhancement is really looking for who had control. And there could be a set of facts where someone does exercise that control over other individuals in a wire transfer. But the fact is, there were no such facts and no such evidence at issue in this case. And that's why we think that it's a problem. There are two options.
Was there any evidence indicating that Mr. Clark received more of the proceeds of the scheme than the others?
The limited evidence that's in the record shows that the opposite happened. The bank account that this was transferred to in Connecticut was in the name of two of his cousins. And those individuals used three-quarters of the money to purchase a CD in their own name. So actually, I think the record shows the money went the other way. If I could just very briefly address the Batson issue that's also in this case, because I think there are it warrants discussion as well. A Batson violation can be either the result of a pattern of improperly exercised peremptory charges or from individual jurors, a single individual juror. And in this case, we think there are both problems, but I'd like to focus on two of the individual jurors that I think most clearly exemplify the problem.
This is independent of your comparison study?
This is independent of the comparison. That's correct.
All right.
The first juror is Juror 1012. Juror 1012 was asked during the voir dire.
Which person is that? Don't give me the number. Which?
Just passing the money.
Exactly.
Is that the condo manager?
It was the condo manager.
Gotcha.
She was asked, as all the potential jurors were, during voir dire, in question number 26, whether she believed she would have difficulty understanding evidence about business records or general principles of accounting. And she answered no. She didn't think she would have any trouble with that. During the individual questioning, she indicated that she was an on-site manager at a condominium, and that her role was to collect money, but not to actually keep the condominium's books. And from that, the prosecutor struck her on the basis that she would not understand the sorts of financial records and accounting principles that were going to be at issue. This is just like the error that was made in the Snyder decision out of the Supreme Court, where a prosecutor offered a purely speculative reason for a strike that did not actually track what had been said. For example, I collect money from my clients when they pay their bills. I pass it on to our accounting department. That doesn't have any indication, give anyone any indication of whether I'm likely to understand accounting principles or not. The clerk's office at the court here collects filing fees, and they presumably pass them on to whomever keeps the court's books. But that doesn't give any indication about whether those individuals are likely to understand or not understand basic accounting principles. So we think that's a problem, and it tracks Snyder. The other error, the individual error that I'd like to point out, involves juror 945, who was a teacher. And this the prosecutor struck this individual for being a teacher. The judge did not agree with that. The judge didn't accept that reason. Instead, what the judge said was, I'm very concerned about that, but I have my own reason I think perhaps this juror might have been struck, and that's because he didn't appear to be alert to me. This is the same problem that the Supreme Court faced in the Miller L case, where it explained that a prosecutor's peremptory challenge has to rise or fall on the reasons the prosecutor gives. And if the stated reason does not hold up, it doesn't matter if a district court or a court of appeals can imagine another reason that might have justified the strike. Because substituting a reason from the position of the bench does nothing to satisfy the prosecutor's burden of stating a racially neutral explanation for their own actions. We think that's exactly what happened here with the teacher, and that's why those two individual jurors present the strongest case or the clearest case of why there was a Batson violation in this case.
So did you start with focusing on these two individual decisions as opposed to your comparison study because of your concession that it's plain error review with respect to that?
That's correct, Your Honor. I think it's easier to resolve this on the clear error.
But can you make a plain error argument on the comparison study?
Certainly. I think there is a plain error argument to be made.
Given our standard, manifest, what is it? Manifest, patent, or unmistakable?
That's right. It's a very high standard.
Yeah, what's your argument about that?
We think it's a very strong standard in language, but with many things, sort of language and practical application of that language can merge. And in this case, to meet the plain error standard, we'd need to show that there was an error, that it was plain, and that it affected Mr. Clark's substantial rights. And to the extent the court finds that there was a plain error in striking some of these jurors when other jurors had similar responses, not identical. We acknowledge they're not identical, but they're similar, that it should have raised the troubling red flag of some sort of pretext. And the district court didn't see that because he wasn't presented with the information. But what the Supreme Court has also said is that when the error is not one, it's not a demeanor objection. Demeanor objections are very difficult to review on a plain error standard. And we think if this were a demeanor objection, we would really have no argument. But the types of facts that we're talking about are ones that are readily accessible from the record. And the comparison is not between jurors who looked nervous and didn't look nervous, but it's jurors who either had an accounting background or didn't have an accounting background, jurors who had a scientific background or didn't have a scientific background, and that those should have caused concern when the prosecutor here struck black juror after black juror, essentially eliminating 80% of the available black jurors at the time the panel was being seated. I'm happy to address Rule 404B and the restitution issues if Your Honors have any questions.
Two questions about that. I just want to back up a minute. I found your addendum using the 3B1.1. Can I ask you what year of version of the guidelines is this taken from?
It should have the date at the top of the page, Your Honor, at the top on the left.
Doesn't.
Oh. Then I will confirm that for you on rebuttal.
I'm just wondering whether the guideline in effect when Mr. Clark was, the application notes were different when Mr. Clark was sentenced. They're the ones I looked at. And this has four application notes. In my memory, I may be wrong, but I thought the version that Mr. Clark was sentenced under only had three.
I believe they are the same, Your Honor.
They are?
I was just handed the 2002. Actually, you are correct that there are three under the 2002.
Well, we can look at it. I don't want to take your time.
Okay, I apologize. Yeah. I'm sorry to correct that. Now that I've been handed the second page, it appears that there are four also under the 2002.
I just wanted to ask you one question about 404B. You say in your brief that it's a common mistake when people argue about 404B. They talk about prior bad acts. But there's nothing prior in 404B. It doesn't require that the act be prior. But you make that argument in your brief at some point, I think, on about page 32 or so. Although the government didn't cite it, there's a case in this circuit that is flatly against your position because it holds that the 404B can be used to admit evidence that bad acts that occur after the charge conduct. The case is United States versus Latney. It's 108 Fed 3rd 1446.
Your Honor, I don't understand us to be arguing that the prior or subsequent is the distinguishing factor. One of the things we pointed out is the temporal difference in that most of the charged conduct here actually occurred before the ATM transaction that's at issue. So the charged acts were actually the prior acts, and the ATM transaction in this case would have been the subsequent act because it occurred after most of the checks and electronic bill payments at issue.
But my point is it doesn't disqualify him for B simply because it occurred after.
I agree. I think it's one factor. The main thing we think here that's relevant on the 404B issue is that there were three particular types of schemes alleged in the indictment. There were three particular types of schemes being presented to the jury. None of them involved ATM transactions. So this is simply another bad act. Whether it was prior or subsequent doesn't matter as much as the fact that it is not, it's not relevant to the facts that the jury was actually being asked to decide, and it was admitted, and the judge...
It showed that he was in charge of the bookkeeping and the accounting, and it shows that he ignored that particular transaction, which would have disclosed the fact that... that the deposit that was attributed to him did not occur.
It has some relevance to the fact that he worked at the bank and did have access to the bank's books, but there were three very particular schemes that were charged, none of which involved this type of access to this type of record keeping. The schemes involved electronic bill payments. They involved writing checks with stop payment issued on them, and they involved wire transfers. And if you look, the judge says a number of times in the transcript when this issue was raised as an objection that this is just coming in to fill in the story. And that's precisely why we think this falls within this court's Bowie decision, indicating that there is no fill in the story, explain the circumstances exception to 404B.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Catherine Kelly on behalf of the United States. Just turning to the 404B issue first, since we're discussing it, we believe the court did, in fact, properly admit the evidence regarding the defendant's submission of the ATM deposit slip without accompanying funds as intrinsic evidence. The court's decision did not simply say that I'm letting this evidence in to complete the story. The court also found that it was an intrinsic part of the charged offense, and that was a proper reason to find that it was, in fact, intrinsic. In this case,
even though it wasn't one of the schemes alleged in the indictment?
It wasn't one of the executions or the types of executions that was indicted. There was only one bank fraud scheme indicted in the indictment itself, and there were three types of examples of executions of that scheme.
I think that's what counsel was referring to.
I believe that's what counsel was referring to. But the bottom line is that, as the court found in letting this evidence in, the ATM evidence is just a different mechanism, but it's the same thing that's happening. This is another method by which the defendant was using his ability to access the computer system at Hoya to manipulate it, either by acts of adding information to the system or not adding information to the system, so that he could take money that belonged to Hoya and keep it for himself. So this was just yet another example. The Pless case that we cite in our brief indicates, this is from this court in 1996, that you're not limited in a bank fraud scheme to presenting evidence of the particular transactions that were charged in the counts themselves. Since the government has to prove the whole scheme, it's not necessary for the government to charge every single act of execution that would be in furtherance of that scheme. So under Pless, we believe that even though this ATM evidence wasn't set forth as a separate execution of the scheme, that it was entirely proper to let it in as part of the evidence that proved the scheme here. Under 404, we believe that the evidence could have been let in.
Is it clear whether the government gave notice prior to trial?
The government did not give 404B, or did not file a 404B notice, because as the government explained at trial, they didn't believe this to be 404B evidence. They believed it to be evidence that was, in fact, intrinsic to the fraud scheme.
But did the government notify the defense counsel that it was going to introduce this ATM transaction?
The government, it turned over the documents related to the ATM transaction in discovery. They put those documents on their exhibit list, which was filed at least 10 days before trial, and then included those documents again in the binders that were handed over to defense counsel before trial. It's pretty clear that defense counsel...
So you think that's enough to comply with the rule?
Given that it is, in fact, intrinsic evidence, I do believe it's enough.
No. But the 404B... two argument that Judge Randolph was asking about.
If, of course, under Rule 404B, there is a requirement that you give notice that is formal
what
notice.
What I found in the record was the district court treated the defendant's counsel's objection as a discovery objection and never ruled on the 404B2, never found that the government had, in fact, given notice.
No, the court did not find anything as to giving 404B notice. However, it didn't, because the court repeatedly said that this was not 404B evidence, that it was, in fact, intrinsic evidence of the bank scheme.
So when the defense counsel objected, one, he didn't get, A, it wasn't intrinsic, B, he didn't get 404B notice, and it was highly prejudicial. There was also a 403 objection within that?
It wasn't a stated 403 objection as to the balancing test.
Highly prejudicial?
We don't believe there was any prejudice here because he was...
No, my question is, if counsel says that...
That it was highly...
This is highly prejudicial.
Well, we don't believe it's highly prejudicial at all. It's very clear that...
No. My question is that objection sufficient to require the district court to consider the balancing under 403?
I don't believe so without anything more explicit requested by defense counsel, just saying it's prejudicial.
So doesn't the defense counsel has to say, Your Honor, I want a 403 balancing. Just want to be sure what the government's position is on this.
We don't believe a 403 balancing is necessary. We believe that the defense counsel would have to ask for that if that was
in
the requirement.
In those words.
We believe so, and we have case law in our brief to support that.
I couldn't find a case that says that.
That it, it, the
This is sort of magic words. I just want to be clear about it. Anyway, I don't want to hold you up on this.
Okay. Well, anyway, in any regard, our ultimate point is that the admission of the ATM evidence, whether it was considered intrinsic to the bank fraud charge or whether or not it could be properly admitted under 404B, its admission was harmless. There was a vast array of independent evidence that the defendant was guilty. The evidence was overwhelming. The government didn't mention the ATM evidence in its closing or rebuttal arguments, contrary to what defense counsel says in its reply brief. There was nothing dramatic or compelling about the ATM evidence that would rivet the jury's attention to it, and the government
never misused it.
The
juror asked about it.
The juror asked a question about it.
Yeah.
But again, it wasn't the focus of the government's case. The government never misused it, most importantly, as propensity evidence to say that just because he did this transaction at the ATM machine, that shows that he's, in fact, guilty of the other executions of the fraud scheme here. And again, given that there's overwhelming evidence of that's independent of the ATM scheme of the defendant's guilt, we believe that regardless of how the court would look at it as a 404B issue or as a item of intrinsic evidence, that its admission was harmless in this case. Turning to the Batson issue, if I may, it's important to note that the condo manager not only didn't answer question 8, in not answering question 8, she also is essentially telling the court that she's not familiar with share drafts, checks, electronic bill payment, or wire transfers. She didn't answer question 26 either, that she had a familiarity with business records, general accounting principles, and so forth, or have any training in those matters. The government gave a neutral...
What about the fact that when the prosecutor was asked by the district court whether other jurors also lacked accounting background, he said, "I don't know." Doesn't that suggest that, I mean, even if you're right, that there's evidence in the record that this particular juror lacked accounting information, the government seemed uninterested in that with respect to other jurors.
No, I don't believe that the court or the government was uninterested in that.
I was just reading his answer. He said, "I don't know."
I think in the moment that the question was asked during the Batson challenge, the government wasn't at that time particularly aware of or unaware. But during the
Well, my point is if the government cared, if the government wanted to be sure the jurors understood accounting practices, accounting procedures, why did it only seem to express that concern with respect to this juror?
Well, this was one of three jurors that the defendant challenged at the trial.
Yeah, but my point is that if the government had worried about this, it would have asked these questions to other jurors, too, to be sure they had accounting skills.
Well, there were other questions asked. The two questions that I mentioned were on the jury questionnaire itself, the written questions ahead of time, and the court and the parties went through these questions and followed up during the individual voir dire. In fact, the comparisons that the defense makes in regard to the juror who was the condo manager show that the people they chose did have either particular familiarity with accounting principles, such as Juror 1395, and who was working as a lobbyist at an accounting firm, and as the other juror, who's number 1282, who had taken accounting, basic accounting in high school and college, and did accounting or worked some financials at his job. So these items were fleshed out during the individual voir dire and actually show that these particular jurors that they're trying to now compare to actually did have accounting experience and more knowledge than this juror who was the condo manager. And for those reasons, we would say that they're not comparable, and it was not a matter of the government being disinterested or that these items were not fleshed out. I think it's a matter of when the government said, "I don't know," during the Batson challenge, as it's a moment in the heat of the jury selection process where at that moment the government couldn't think of somebody off the top of their head.
Let me ask you, does the record show what information the district court itself had? The supplemental appendix only has summary statements about race and gender. Did the district court, he had the answers to the 45 questions. Is that correct?
Yes, the individual voir dire was done after the jurors had answered the 45 questions.
What I mean is all the members of the voir dire were required to answer these 45 questions.
That's correct, yeah.
Then the answers went to the district court?
Any question that was answered, yes, the district court with the parties addressed those questions at the bench.
What I'm trying to understand is what information the district court itself had.
Whether, for instance, the juror is handing up the questionnaire and the court is... It's not clear. It's not clear whether or not the juror themselves were handing over their questionnaire to the court at the time, but it is clear that the court is going through with each juror any question on which they answered yes or that they checked. So there's no explanation.
When the district court says, I don't have the information. I'm trying to understand what the district court is referring to because he has the answers. He asked for the answers to the questions, so presumably he had them.
That's correct. I mean, my impression is just that perhaps he doesn't have answers as to what individuals' occupations were unless they were specifically
asked.
That's
my next question. When you are called to jury duty, you have to fill out a form that answers all these questions. Does the district court have that?
It's not clear from the record.
Do counsel have it?
I believe there was something in the supplement.
Well, let me say, I only know from my own personal experience, and I don't want to talk about that, but I tried to find out if the rules or anything like that indicate precisely what information the district court has. And it's in the record what race, gender, occupation, place of residence, all that's in the record.
Mm-hmm.
And for counsel to be able to know anything about the jurors, presumably counsel would have access to that information. And so would the district court. That's what I'm trying to understand when the district court says, I don't have that information.
I am not certain what that means, Your Honor, at all, other than what we had in the transcript.
Is there any way to supplement the record so we know?
I would be happy to try and do that, Your Honor. I'm not certain what information is available other than what...
No, it's not a question of what's available. It's a question of what information,
the process by
which the district court is informed about the members of the veneer. And what information did the district court have?
I will certainly try and find that out for Your Honor, yes. Turning back to our main point with the Batson issue, though, however, is just ultimately...
That is the Batson issue. That's part of it.
Yeah, no, certainly. But our ultimate point with the Batson issue is the court accepted the government's explanations of its strikes and found that the government... There wasn't information...
Well, what about Judge Tatel's question earlier about the district court's statement he was very concerned about the prosecutor's explanation that no teacher could give the government a fair shake? That's almost a direct quote. He said, my siblings are teachers.
That's correct. And
so
we,
did the judge ever rule that that was a permissible explanation? What I read in the transcript is the judge finesses that, and he goes on to say, well, I would have struck this person anyway because I was concerned that he was sleeping.
The judge after that, first of all, the strike against the teacher is not preserved because that was not one of the objections the defense counsel made at trial as to the strikes.
I'm not clear about that. The defense counsel says, Your Honor, I'm raising a Batson objection.
Right, and he mentioned three.
Five of the six strikes were of black jurors, and then they start talking about who jurors are. What is not preserved?
After the government explained its strikes of the black jurors, defense counsel was asked to comment on those, and in a very generous reading, he preserved three objections to the condo manager, the juror that worked at the credit union and to the man who said that he tested computer software in his job.
In other words, the judge himself expressed the objection, correct?
Correct. The judge, when the government gave the explanation and then later on said that he had concerns that it wasn't a sufficient justification to conclude that a teacher wouldn't give the government a fair trial. However, the judge never said, I find that to be pretextual, I find that to be a discriminatory reason. And ultimately, after
he
saying...
He never found it wasn't. That's no. What I'm trying to get. I mean, I read this everywhere I thought it might be, and he just never ruled on it, did he?
No, we believe ultimately after saying that on pages 372 and 73 of the joint appendix, even after the court said, I also saw that that particular teacher juror was sleeping and was going to have his own concerns about that, he then said, based on the record I have before me, I would have to conclude that there hasn't been a sufficient showing to conclude that there's been a Batson violation.
So it's that summary at the end, even though there's no statement other than his concern about striking a person because the person is a teacher.
Both before that statement and after, the court said that although he had concerns that our view of it is that the court is saying essentially that I don't agree that a juror who's a teacher would be a bad juror.
Well, the Supreme Court has said it's the district court's obligations to make findings.
Right. Which we
And if the judge doesn't make a finding in the record that's clear, then it's for this court to evaluate.
Right, and we believe that the court did make such a finding. The court mentioned the concerns about being a teacher as a sufficient basis to strike, but he didn't know if anybody else was a teacher or not, and not having such information makes it very difficult because generally in the Batson context, the government or defense makes representations.
Wouldn't he know that from the jury question? Isn't that the first question people answer, what their profession is?
I believe that that's information that the court and the parties have. In regard to that before the parties come forth.
Otherwise, how would the prosecutor have known?
They were asked what their occupation was during the individual voir dire also.
Right.
So is it your point that it was defense counsel's obligation to explain to the court, yes, there were other teachers on the jury and this question wasn't asked to them? So does this go to the comparative study problem?
Well, first of all, the court said that didn't know if anybody else was a teacher or not. And then in the Batson context, generally there's information brought to bear suggesting that there are other
Why
individuals.
Why would you need any comparison for that particular strike?
Because it's not pretextual. There's case law.
Obviously pretextual. I mean, for someone to say that we struck this teacher because teachers are... likely to be in favor of forgiveness or whatever.
No, we don't believe it's pretextual at all. There's case law both in the 10th and the 11th Circuit saying that there's no racially discriminatory intent where prosecutors have struck teachers.
Which circuits
because they're not teachers. The 10th Circuit in Nelson and the 11th Circuit in Steele, which we've cited.
This could be wrong.
The bottom line is that the government's explanation.
I mean, the other thing to remember is the demographics of the District of Columbia.
That's correct. That's correct. That is another factor that you have to take into account, along with all the other accounting factors, such as that the government had planned to strike a white female juror, but the defense got to them first. The subject matter of the case was not racially sensitive. There was no extrinsic indicators of discrimination in this case, such as a general policy by the U.S. Attorney's Office to strike black jurors. But getting back to what the government said.
To strike teachers.
No. Even if there were, which I have no awareness of, if you choose to strike teachers regardless of their race, that is still not pretext. It's not a discriminatory intent, which is what the government explained in saying this is why we struck the teacher. It had been this particular prosecutor's experience that trying cases in Superior Court, teachers were more likely to give a benefit of doubts to a defendant, and that was why this particular they was going to strike this teacher.
There's nothing discriminatory about
No, and the court might not agree that jurors who are teachers don't, you know, give a break more to a defendant, but that doesn't make that reason discriminatory.
In criminal tax cases, the tax division makes it a practice of striking farmers. Do you know why?
Probably because they receive government subsidies, I would think.
No, because their tax returns are so complicated that they just absolutely hate the Internal Revenue Service.
So do we need evidence in this case, for example, that, you know, 95% of the teachers who are residents of the District of Columbia are black?
No, we don't need anything like that.
Hear me out. Is that what you're saying would be required to show that a strike based on being a teacher is pretextual?
You would need, I would believe, some evidence other than the explanation that I've, as a prosecutor, have had experiences where teachers have not ruled favorably on me.
The judge
there would have to be more.
For a long time, very familiar with the District of Columbia, very familiar with teachers.
Correct, and ultimately decided that the government's reasons for their strikes.
That's what he says, I'm very concerned about this.
But said that there wasn't enough evidence to conclude that the reasons given by the government were not genuine or that the strikes were for racial reasons, and that's ultimately the court's ruling at the end of the day.
And that's at 373?
373, Your Honor. And that's ultimately, despite whatever concerns he stated, he's ultimately at the end of the day saying, I am accepting the government's reasons for their strikes as not being racially motivated, and I don't have additional information that allows me to find that the strikes were for racial reasons. And given the explanation, even in regard to the teacher that the prosecutor gave, he's not doing it for racial reasons. There's nothing about that strike that you can say is for a racial reason. And for all of those reasons, and the fact that the comparisons that are made post hoc here on plain error review just simply don't show the types of similarities that the defense would like to show, we believe that the Batson challenge was properly denied by the district court. And if I could just turn very quickly to the 404 or the sentencing issue, we believe that regardless of whether or not it's necessary to supervise others, the court in this case found that the defendant here had been the organizer or leader of the cousin and the cousin's wife who received the wire transfer to their
bank account. This is the mastermind comment?
The mastermind. And he's not saying, in making that comment, the court is not saying the mastermind of the entire bank fraud scheme. He's saying the mastermind of the conspiracy. If the court recalls, the conspiracy that was charged was account that was with the cousin, the cousin's wife, and the defendant. So he's saying that he was the mastermind of that conspiracy.
There was no objection.
There was no objection. This is all on plain error review. Not through these grounds.
Yeah, the defendant objected to on the basis that the conspiracy count had been dropped and therefore you can't give me an enhancement under D1.
Right, but then even the defense counsel conceded that was still relevant evidence.
And the pre-sentence report spelled this out clear.
Correct.
What did defense counsel concede?
The defense counsel, it appeared he was just making an objection on behalf of his client, saying that I know that count 9, the conspiracy charge, is being dismissed at the sentencing, but
so there's no
my client essentially wants me to say that since that's being dismissed, that should not I shouldn't be considered a leader or an organizer.
And that's your point, that the organizer and mastermind comment only went to the conspiracy.
Well, the court is saying that. It was specifically said that he was the mastermind of this conspiracy. The defendant's point
I just need to understand why you don't think the defendant's objection was sufficient.
Because the defendant is saying that I'm objecting to the organizer or leader enhancement because count 9 is being dismissed.
Right.
And then
and that's
defense
the
counsel.
Only basis
right.
of
he's not,
the
he's,
finding that he is a mastermind.
Now, I'm not sure if I'm being clear, Your Honor.
Okay.
At the sentencing...
Oh, I can check it out in the record.
No, finish your sentence, would you? Go ahead. Yeah. Explain.
There was no objection in the PSR. At the sentencing, defense counsel said, we're objecting because the conspiracy count is being dismissed. So
okay.
For that
Which
reason...
Which involves a proposition of law that you can't get a 3B1 enhancement if there's no conspiracy charge, and that's just not the law.
Right, and the defense counsel recognized that and said, but I have told my client that it's still considered to be relevant conduct for sentencing purposes. So he's acknowledging that and moving on. He's never saying we don't think that this leader-organizer enhancement applies because he didn't lead or organize anybody. That was absolutely not the objection that was made, and for that reason it hasn't been preserved. But in any event,
that he was not the mastermind
of the conspiracy, involving the cousin and the cousin's wife.
And so that's dropped?
The government ultimately dismissed that charge.
And that's what counsel was focusing on.
Right. And
so
then saying, I still know that
that's... Since the mastermind finding was tied to the conspiracy, and that's being dropped, that's what I don't quite understand about your position. Why isn't that a sufficient objection?
Because he's not saying that I am objecting because he didn't lead or organize somebody. He's just saying, I think because count nine is being dismissed, you shouldn't count that. But he's also at the same time recognizing that for sentencing purposes is still relevant conduct. So defense counsel is then coming back around and saying, I know it's relevant conduct. So that ultimately saying that the court could consider it. And at no time did defense counsel object to the leader organizer enhancement, saying that this doesn't apply because he didn't lead or organize anybody. And the court found sufficient facts to apply that enhancement, given that the defendant is working at the bank. He's sending the money. The money is then immediately withdrawn by the owners of the bank account up in Connecticut, which shows that he is directing them. And that goes along, frankly, with the strong inference that you can get from all the evidence in this case. It's the defendant who is driving the train on the entire bank fraud. He's the one going into the computer system and making changes, or not making changes, as it were, in certain sense. He's the one that's reaping the rewards of the conspiracy, or rather the bank fraud. He's the accountant at Hoya. He's using his other friend's account. So there's certainly no reason to believe, given his operations throughout the bank fraud, that he's not in fact leading and organizing this conspiracy and directing his cousins at the same time. Certainly they had to be told that the money is just, it's in your account now, go get it. And so for those reasons, we believe that the court was properly increasing the offense level under 3B1.1. We believe you do, because the only part that the government is conceding is that for ex post facto purposes, the wrong version of the guidelines was used. But we're not conceding that the court improperly increased the offense level under 3B1.1C for the role as leader and organizer. And the other point we would make in regard to that is that the most defendant should get out of this, if he gets anything, is that the court could more sufficiently explain the rationale for applying that enhancement in a remand.
What is the consequence in terms of time, given the government's concession? What's the difference in terms of imprisonment?
In regard to the ex post facto clause, it ultimately, given Judge Walton had made a ruling yesterday in denying release pending appeal, he said that he would essentially drop it 6 months for the ex post facto reason.
Well, he said this yesterday?
There was a motion by defense counsel to have the defendant release pending appeal, and that was denied yesterday, and the court said that I recognize the ex post facto issue as a problem, that the defendant was sentenced to the high end of the guidelines under the 2010 version, and that he would, on remand, be sentencing. He's indicating he's going to sentence him to the high end of the guidelines within the earlier version, which would drop it 6 months, ultimately. And the court was saying that it believed that it had properly increased the offense level under 3B1.1C, and that it wouldn't change.
So it's 21 months minus 6?
Minus 6, yes. Yes.
And when does that... When does he hit the 15-month point?
The 6 months from, I believe his release date now is in March 2015, so it would be...
You mean if it's reduced 6 months?
Approximately, if you take 6 months off,
His release date is when?
Probably October 2014, if I'm doing the math correctly. That would take 6 months off of it.
So we're talking about March?
March 2015 is the current release date.
March 2015. What?
Yeah.
That's the current release.
That's the current release date.
Oh, so 6 months before that.
6 months before that, which I guess is about October
about a year from
2014,
that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. But in that order, the court, Judge Walton was expressing that he believed that he had properly sentenced him under 3B1.1C for the leader and organizer. He issued a written order about 4:45 yesterday, is my understanding. On that issue.
And finally, on the restitution issue, is this a question of first impression?
It is in this court, I believe, Your Honor, has it, or the court.
Well, you cited the Seventh and First Circuit cases.
Yes, it's not an issue of first impression in other circuits. The First Circuit
made question of first impression here.
Yes, it is a question of first impression here. But the Dorsley decision that defense counsel cites just simply doesn't involve a scheme, which is really the true issue at heart here.
So you adopt Judge Rovner's position?
Judge, I'm sorry.
You cite Pugh on remand.
We cited Pugh, yes. That was then also Matos, which was a wire fraud case.
Are you adopting the position in that court? That's what I'm wondering.
Yes, we would adopt that position.
Is the distinction is between convicted conduct?
Convicted. If you're convicted of an offense that involves a scheme, then all the loss due to that scheme can be considered properly within a restitution order, even if there is certain counts in that scheme that are acquitted conduct.
Acquitted. Right.
So the Seventh Circuit just focused on the different burden of proof that the government had at trial and at sentencing, and defined the offense of conviction in terms of a scheme.
That's correct. That's what the mandatory victim or the Mandatory Victims Restitution Act requires also. The Dorsley case here didn't involve a scheme, but the Pugh case, the Matos case, the Hanoud case in the Fourth Circuit, they all involved schemes. And the Dickerson case in the Third Circuit also said that Huey's all but eviscerated by the MVRA with respect to crimes involving schemes. So you're looking at the full amount. And also the amount that's truly at issue, if any, here is only a little over $1,300, because that's the only amount that is specifically related to count four, which was the acquitted conduct in this case. But given that he was convicted of counts one through three, which were all bank fraud offenses too, it's proper under the decisions I've stated to include the amount attributable to count four as well.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors, and we respectfully request that the court uphold the decision of the district court. Thank you.
All right, counsel for appellant.
Very briefly, Your Honors, to begin with Batson, we think the problem with the two jurors that we've identified on the record here, juror 1012, the condo manager, and the teacher, are both preserved. They were preserved because defense counsel made a Batson objection to each of the five strikes. As to juror 1012, the condo manager, the government's I don't know response, which Judge Tatel highlighted, is the same sort of speculation that was in Snyder, where the Supreme Court found there was clear error in the district court not sustaining the Batson violation.
On the teacher, what about what the district court said, that he just, you know, without a comparative, without knowing whether there were other teachers, he just couldn't?
It doesn't decide. Appear that that was actually the basis for the district court sustaining.
But that's what he said.
But when he actually referred to, on JA 372 and 373, he specifically said he had concerns about saying that just because someone is a teacher, that's a sufficient justification to conclude they're not going to give the government a fair trial. But as I say, I saw that he was sleeping, and I am going to have my own concerns about him being on the panel because of the fear he may not be alert. And then he goes on to say, so he will conclude that there's not been a Batson violation.
So we should ignore his statement about not knowing about other teachers?
He did ask, in a number of situations, he asked if there were other similarly.
Don't we have to look at the whole, everything the judge says? I mean, this isn't a written order, right?
That's right.
So we have to look, this is an experienced district judge, right?
Absolutely.
We look at all the reasons he gives, and one of the reasons he gave was that without knowing about whether there were other teachers on the jury, I just can't decide this. We can't ignore that statement, can we?
I'm not sure that he goes so far as to say without knowing that I can't decide it. He does indicate that it makes it more difficult, and we agree that it does make it more difficult to not have that information.
So it's ambiguous as to whether he made a finding?
I think actually what is clear is that the reason he sustained the challenge is because of his own concerns that the juror was not going to be alert, and there was nothing that overrode those concerns that anyone else had presented to him. I think that's what the statement on JA 373 makes clear.
So the judge is finessing the question about the teacher objection?
I think finessing is one characterization. Substituting his own explanation or augmenting what the prosecutor provided is, I think, another characterization. Briefly on 404B, I just want to mention that the government did file a 404B notice as to other evidence. It was simply this ATM transaction evidence that the government chose not to include in that. So there was a 404B issue presented to the district court, and this was just not encompassed within it.
Now, the government says that even if there was a 404B problem, it's harmless. And did you respond to that in your reply brief?
I believe that we did, and one of our bold headings discussing the 404B evidence explains that it was not harmless. And then the section under that heading of the brief goes on to explain why this became a looming question in the case that was referred to in the starting from the government's opening statement, but also repeatedly throughout witness testimony in the case. And in fact, a juror did ask a question about it, and there are numerous indications that this became kind of one of the key fact disputes that was presented, was what happened with this ATM transaction and who was responsible. Mm-hmm. Briefly on 3B1.1, you asked Judge Randolph what the statement in Quigley was referring to when it referred to all persons must have control in order for there to be this enhancement. Quigley actually cites an earlier, a 1998 D.C. Circuit decision, U.S. v. Graham, for the statement that all persons receiving this enhancement.
And Graham wasn't a 1.1C case either. And there's also a statement in Graham that says that as far as that application note 4, that no one of the factors mentioned in application note 4 is dispositive. One of the factors mentioned in note 4 is control. So if you take the statement in Graham and you apply it, it means that control is not dispositive. And yet you're making control dispositive in this case.
Well, I think this court's own precedent has made control a dispositive issue. And those factors that are listed, although one explicitly refers to control, many of the others, if not all of them, are getting at whether there is, in fact, control, such that there is a reason to find someone more culpable than the other folks who are involved. And on this point, I do want to emphasize that we believe our objection was preserved. The court-appointed counsel below passed it along on behalf of his defendant, that without the conspiracy facts and without the conspiracy charge, that there was no longer a basis for it. We think at JA 49 and 50, the district court's ruling on the enhancement makes clear that the district court understood what the basis of the challenge was and walked through the facts that he thought were sufficient. As in Quigley, we think an appropriate remedy for this will be to ask the district court.
Is that your response to the argument, government counsel's argument, that this issue is forfeited?
Yes.
So you agree it wasn't raised, but the district court went through the analysis?
No, we think that it was raised. At JA 46, defense counsel makes clear that he's passing along on behalf of his client an objection to this enhancement. Uh-huh. And then the district...
On the ground that the conspiracy charge was brought.
Right, and I think one fair...
That's not a legally recognized objection.
Well, I think one fair reading of what the district court is passing along is the fact that without the conspiracy, this enhancement only applies when you have multiple participants. So if you don't have a conspiracy, you don't have multiple participants, you don't have any basis for finding the type of control.
Conspiracy, even if you don't charge conspiracy.
I agree. I'm not disagreeing with you on that, Judge Randolph.
And the only basis for the objection was that I'm not charged with conspiracy anymore. Therefore, it follows that I can't get the enhancement under 3B1. That's just wrong.
Well, I think that the district court's response to the objection shows that the district court understood that objection to also encompass whether there was a sufficient factual basis, once there was no conspiracy allegation at issue in the case, whether there was a sufficient factual basis. And that's why the district court walked through what it felt were the sufficient facts, which were namely that there was a transfer of money and that the individuals who received that money withdrew some of it. And we think, as in Quigley, at a minimum, when this case goes back for resentencing on the ex post facto issue, the district court should either be asked to expand its fact-finding to show that this enhancement is warranted or to conclude that it is not, in fact, warranted. There are no further questions. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Excuse me. Can we do that without making a judgment on whether he was wrong? I mean, can we just say, okay, the government concedes that it's got to go back on applying the right guidelines? And by the way, while he's doing that, would you please expand your reasoning on this? Why would we do that? Unless we thought the district court was wrong.
So the court has taken two different approaches. In the Carter case I cited, the court found that on the record there was no basis for application of the 3B1.1 enhancement and simply reversed it out of hand. In Quigley, what the court said was, on the record as it comes to us, we see no basis for this enhancement. So we're sending it back for the district court to either make additional fact findings or to conclude that this enhancement should not be applied and to resentence the defendant accordingly.
Did he do that yesterday?
I have not received the order that was issued yesterday. I'm not on the ECF for the district court.
Okay.
Thank you.